I'm Mike, I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is February 25th, 2004. I have a sponsor, and I'm available to sponsor others. And so I asked my sponsor to speak for me 3 years ago for this anniversary. And I remember talking to my wife about it first, and she's like, well, maybe you should get 8 years before you worry about 10 years. But, you know, my sponsor speaks a lot, and I wanted to get him booked before he got booked up. So I jumped on it quick. And I remember we had gone to – the night I asked him, we went to a meeting, and this guy's sponsor gave him a chip. And he read this portion out of the book, and, I mean, it was like it was poetry. I was like, man, that's awesome. I was like – I remember turning to my sponsor, and I asked him to speak for me, and I said, are you going to say something like that when you speak for me? And he turned to me. And he's, and my children are here, so I won't say exactly what he said. But I'll paraphrase. He said, if you want to have a sponsor that says nice things about you, maybe you should get a different sponsor. So, you know, I'm a little worried. But, you know, when he first started sponsoring me, he told me that the first relationship I'm ever going to have is with him. And then all of my other relationships will grow from that. And that's absolutely been my experience. You know, Ryan's been one of the only constants in my life since I got sober. And he's been there for every milestone of my life. When I got married, when my children were born, you know, my daughter went to the hospital when, the first year she was born, and he was the first guy there. You know, he dropped everything. He came over to see if everything was okay, and he's always been there for us. You know, and he's the godfather of my daughter, you know, and it's a relationship that I never thought I'd have. It was a relationship I never thought I'd have when I came into AA, certainly. And I'm very grateful for that. You know, he's always been an example of Alcoholics Anonymous and what you can do with Alcoholics Anonymous in your life. And, you know, this year's been a struggle. I'm not going to lie. It's been rough. It's been a rough year for me. Had a lot go on. And, you know, recently I've been in a lot of physical pain, and it's just been a really, really struggle. But, and Ryan moved away this year, and I've always been able to meet him at a meeting once a week or see him here, see him there. And, you know, we don't get to do that so much anymore. So it's more like trying to catch him on the phone, and it's just been a struggle. But, you know, I wouldn't trade anything, you know, the relationship I have with my sponsor to, you know, really everything I have from Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't trade it for anything. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a life that I never thought I had would have, you know. When I walked in, I came in with my wife and my kids, and Ryan walked up, and he goes, well, you certainly didn't have any of this when you got here, you know. So, anyways, I'll stop rambling. Ryan.
My name's Ryan. I'm an alcoholic. I think I've hugged Mike 10 times now, so that's pretty good. I got sober November 24th of 2002, and my home group is the College Park Triangle Group. We meet 7 o'clock Thursday nights in Orlando. Anybody's welcome to come, but I probably won't see most of you here there because you'll be here. But, you know, it's funny seeing Jake celebrate and Dave speak for him and Mike. It's like a reunion, you know, of sorts. I got sober with those guys. You know, Dave literally, and Mike was like our first crazy newcomer that we, you know, he was like our guy on the couch almost or something like that. So we just made fun of him a lot more. We weren't just, you know, awe-inspiring and nice to him. We would do things like we had a hurricane, and so we all evacuate to our friend's house, and because we all had to, but Mike didn't. And so we made him, you know, come, and we're like, and bring your thick skin, you know, and we just made fun of him for the entire evacuation period. And, but in the same spot, he's right, you know, you know, those relationships are so important to me. You know, my sponsor was in Orlando on Monday night, and I stayed up almost till 1 o'clock in the morning, which, if you know me, I don't do that anymore. You know, I get up real early for work, and but he was there, and that's a relationship. When I see him, I want to spend time with him. And it's like that with Dave and Mike and our friend Eric, who moved away. But, you know, to watch those things take place in his life and just to have some idea that I got to be a very, very, very small part that Dr. Bob talks about, and watching him have kids and get married and stand up in his wedding, and my wife's the godmother of one of his kids, and I'm the godfather of the other. And, you know, it's like Dave's, none of that was imaginable. You know what I mean? When I got here, I just, none of that was anywhere on my horizon, because I didn't care about that kind of stuff. You know, I was the type of self-centered drunk where I didn't think much past my own nose, you know. So I didn't think about God, God of my own understanding, a higher power. I didn't think about friends. I thought about how am I going to feel better right this second. And that was it. And that was the extent. And, you know, I was a weird, weird kid growing up. I cried a lot then, you know. And my parents got divorced when I was like 3. I fractured my skull when I was 4. I had to wear a helmet for a year with stickers on it. That's never cool. You know what I mean? Like, no matter what you do to it, you're not getting a lot of friends in pre-K. And then I was the only Jewish kid in a Catholic school for 8 years. You know what I mean? So I could have told you all of the reasons why I was different from you. But really what I had is I had a spiritual illness. So I have what the book talks about. It, you know, it talks about 12 and 12 is a soul sickness. You know, I had absolutely there's nothing I could do to change the way I felt about my surroundings. My brain cooked for as long as I can remember. And everything changed for me when I was about 8 years old. And I was in Miami with all my cousins, and they were all older than me, and they all lived in Miami together, and I lived here in Tampa, and I felt like the odd, weird kid out, you know. And my cousin Michael laid down on the ground, and he put the tap of a keg in his mouth, and he started drinking. And I just wanted to be like Michael because he could break dance and skateboard, and that had a lot of currency in 1989 or whenever it was. And, you know, it's like I wanted to be like him. And I thought that's how you drink out of a keg. I'd never seen it happen before. I didn't know the procedure. So I lay down on the ground. I put the tap in my mouth, and I started drinking. And I drank enough because I wanted to look cool. And I remember it tasted so bad. You know, I like the first drink of beer when you're a kid and you're into, like, high C and orange juice and stuff. It's got a, you know, serious taste to it. And I wanted to look cool. But then I stood up and I got the effect. I got what alcohol does for me anytime I've ever drank. And what it does for me is for the first time in my life, I didn't need to be anywhere else. I was okay with the way you looked at me, and I was okay with the way I felt about myself. And I knew that instantly. The second I stood up, I had the biggest smile I think I'd ever had in my entire life on. You know, because my life was different. It was off my back, and I could just breathe easy. The second part about alcoholism is that I have the phenomenon of craving. I was 8. I didn't know any of those words at the time. But I know I laid back down on the ground and started drinking and kept drinking because if I stopped, this feeling would slip away. And so I got drunk and I passed out and I vowed to do that as often as I could. You know, obviously it's hard when you're a kid to do that often. But by the time I was 17, I'd gotten into college and I was a daily drunk. And I filled up a water bottle full of vodka, and I took it to school with me every morning, and I started drinking in the morning. And with all the resolution to go to college and do better, and I was going to the number one party school in the nation that year, 1999, rated in Playboy magazine. I don't know where else they rate it, but that's the one I saw. And I thought, what a great school. You know what I mean? Like, number one party school in the nation. I didn't think about any kind of academic credentials, just that. And I got loaded with a bunch of sorority chicks and my best friend when I was up there, when I was like 16. And I thought the college life was going to be me and my best friend since kindergarten and 80 sorority girls. You know, like, it's a little delusional because my college career, there was no sorority girls to be seen. You know what I mean? No other girls liked me either. And I had one friend, you know, and it wasn't that guy from kindergarten. He was just worried about me all the time. And obviously, you know, being a daily drunk, I failed out of school pretty quick. Quick enough. I didn't set any records in that, but in the same spot, I failed golf class, which is that's got to be some sort of record. You know what I mean? Like, I took the midterm and got a 98. I took the midterm because I showed up to get some of that buddy's pee because I was trying to pass a drug test to watch This Is It Ruby Tuesdays. And he's the only guy I knew with clean pee. And that would give it to me at least. You know, it's a little weird question to ask random people. But I went to see him as a midterm. I got a 98. You know, it's not hard. It's golf. It's an easy class. And I missed the midterm, the final. I failed. I failed every class I was in for the last year I was up there. There wasn't any big to-do about it. I just got a letter in the mail that said, and the worst part was to my parents' house, that said, please don't come back. You know, longer, more professional, but that was the gist. And so I moved down here into Tampa, and my parents were done with me because I'd been spending all of their money for 3 years doing all this, you know, just wasting it. So they were like, here's a little bit of money. You can get a security deposit on a house, but we don't want you around the house. You know, don't worry about coming over for free dinner. Just go do whatever you want to do. Go to college if you want. Get a job. We don't care. But pay your own bills, you know, because we do care about that. So I get this little house around Davis Island, right? Everyone here has been here. I've been telling my story in Orlando some, and nobody knows. But, you know, it's the two pizza joints and 7-Eleven. That's kind of it, right? You know, there's not much else. And so I live behind that 7-Eleven, and I worked in one of those pizza joints delivering pizza. Every afternoon, about 3, I'd wake up, You know, and I would go to that 7-Eleven and I would get a 12-pack of beer and I would put it on ice and I'd put it in the back seat of my car and I would start drinking. And I would go to that job, start at 4 because I was an ambitious guy, and I would start driving, delivering these pizzas around your neighborhoods, you know, drinking, driving. I got in a small TV that I watched. I plugged it into the cigarette adapter in my car and had like rabbit ear that stuck out the passenger window, but that didn't stop me, you know. And so I was watching that, and every night at 10 or 11, I'd get off of work, and they'd pay me in cash. And they were connected to a bar that served liquor, so I would reinvest that cash into their establishment. I would just, it was like one hand to the other, right, to the bartender. And I would get drunk. And every night at 2:55, I would always look at my watch, and I would start that run to the 7-Eleven. And I'm a daily drunk. I drink a lot. I drink a 12-pack during the day while I'm working. I drink whiskey all night long. I'm the type of drunk where my feet don't move real well and my head gets real heavy and it feels like you're on a boat, you know? So, like, you take a step and the ground just vanishes, right? And so you just keep falling and then you're laying on the ground and then that makes it harder to get to the 7-Eleven in time. And, you know, so I'm running there and I get there about, you know, that head forward run that we do, you know, and just trying to maintain. And I get to the 7-Eleven, I get as much beer as I can. It's going to make me sleep until morning. And I never sleep. Every morning at 6:55, I'm on that corner, and I'm watching people go to work. And I'm watching them go in with their shirt and tie on, and I'm watching them get their coffee and their bagel and their newspaper. And I remember just thinking to myself every morning, I can never be like them. You know, not that I didn't want to. I absolutely would have traded my life. I wasn't some, like, cool under-the-radar guy that was going to live on the road or anything like that. You know, like, my life was terrible. I didn't do anything but drink. I didn't do anything but worry about myself. And I knew that these people walking in didn't steal money out of their single mom's purse the night before to keep getting loaded, and I had. You know, I knew these people didn't walk into their friends' houses and stick stuff in their pocket and leave and say they got sick or they had to go because I had to keep getting drunk. I knew these people weren't doing. They may or may not have been, but just from the looks of it, it didn't look like they weren't. They looked like they weren't, and I knew I could not do that stuff. I was the type of drunk where sometimes I just slept where I fell, you know, like one of those guys. So front yard, the bench right outside of my prestigious job, you know, like the cook's waking me up in the morning, like, hey, amigo, you okay? You know, like that kind of stuff. And like, yeah, I'm good. Just resting, you know, like I'm fine. And that poor guy, he was like the only normal guy we worked with. He was just working hard. He's a Spanish guy. He spoke almost no English. He worked in an Italian place making Italian food. And he was the only normal person. You know what I mean? All the rest of us were just terrible drunks. And he would, like, do that with us. He'd just pull us up off the couch. He would cover for the dishwasher guy that robbed the liquor cabinet or the wine cabinet in the back of all the cooking wine. You know, and he would do all those things, poor guy. But that's the type of drunk I am. You know, I'm just a loser. I that's not anything I had to work hard at. That came naturally to me. You know what I mean? Like, I am good loser. And that was the way my life looked. And, you know, I guarantee any of those people walking in that 7-Eleven that morning were thinking the same thing. Look at this kid. You know what I mean? Do something with your life. And I wish I could have. But what happened for me was every night was like that. 6 months, probably, I drank like that. And I really, towards the end, wanted to stop. I wanted something to happen in my life. And I don't know if I prayed or when I prayed, but all I know is that at some point in my life, God intervened. And my parents asked me what was wrong with me, and for the first time in my life, I could be honest with them, and I said, I can't stop drinking, I need your help. And they said, all right. My dad, he got in the car. He lived on Davis Island, also in the nice area, you know what I mean, not with the losers like me on the other side. But he came over there, and he walked up to my front door, and I opened it, and bugs started flying out, because when you're drunk like me, you don't do dishes, you know, you don't clean up after yourself, trash accumulates, and it's like a nesting place for animals, you know. So they just come, you know. I don't know how, it's like magic almost. They appear, and I remember when they appeared. I had all these dishes in my sink, and I just threw them all out, you know, because I'm not gonna wash them, you know. Gone. I'll eat off pizza cardboard tops from now on. And so he saw that. He took one look and he said, "Get some stuff and meet me in the car," you know. And so I got in the car. I got a couple things to change into, and he slept on the floor next to my bed that night with his head against the door, so I couldn't escape. And the motion detector's on in the house, in case I did, the entire neighborhood would know I was out and about. And by the time we had gotten back to my house, my stepmom had locked up every, you know, piece of alcohol in that house. There's a big bike lock on the fridge, you know, so it's like, there's no idea we trust you. You know what I mean? It's like, now we know what you're like. We know what you're going to do. All the liquor was under lock and key, and I started to detox. You know, by 3 in the morning, I was sick. I was shaky. I felt terrible. I'd wake up after like 10 minutes of sleep, like I'd just gotten out of a cold shower, and it hurt. And I sweated it out for a few days, and I went to this rehab. And if you're a loser like me, rehab's great, you know, like especially this one, because they didn't really expect much out of us. They gave us three meals, you know, and you went to meetings all day and then smoked a ton of cigarettes in between them. You know, it's like awesome. It's like summer camp for drunken adults. You know, this is like this is great. I wore sweatpants the entire time I was there. You know, it was awesome. And what they did do is they took us every night to outside meetings during the week, and on the weekends they would bring meetings in. And I got to tell you, I've seen good and natured, educated people to try and solve my problems. You know, when I was 16, my parents took me every Wednesday to get hypnotized by some guy, you know, and every Wednesday I would act like, how do you laugh when you're hypnotized? I don't know. I just pretend like I am, like, oh, yeah, you know, and one of those things because I'm too self-centered to have it work, you know what I mean? But the reason I say that is because I see all these people. Since my parents got divorced when I was three, I've seen these doctors, and I was never honest with them once. My last doctor fired me because I would call her in blackouts in the middle of the night, and her office was out of her house, right? So that's not nice. When the phone rings at 3 a.m, it's like next door in your house, and I'm leaving like slurred messages, like I need an appointment for soon. You know, I'm going crazy. And then she would call me back and make an appointment, and then I would cancel or I wouldn't show up because I'd be drunk. And so you do that enough times with a good-natured person, they'll stop being so good-natured and just say, stop doing this. You know, no more calling. If you want to get better, call me. But until then, I'm done. You know, and but this guy came in on some Saturday night, and he told his story. And he was sober like 6 years, and he was like 26 years old, and he told my story. And I absolutely related on a gut level to everything he talked about. And I went up to him after the meeting, and I said, I'm Ryan, and I think I'm just like you. I think I have alcoholism or something to that extent. And then he talked to me like a good person in AA does for 10 or 15 minutes. I didn't listen to a word he said from then on, you know, because I'm thinking about me again at that point. And it'd been 10 seconds. And so, but it gave me hope. It gave me hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. It gave me an idea that there's some place that a guy like me can go to get better. And so I wanted to go there. I really did. Funny thing is I saw another guy. Some of y'all might know him, Big Daddy Todd. He was at some random meeting that he'd never been to before in his life, and he was speaking at it. And we got very different stories, except for with our relationship with alcohol. And he told his story, and I related to him. And the good news about him was he'd never been there before. He just happened to be there that night. And he was a member of this home group at the time. And so when I got here, I had a familiar face. And, you know, all those, you know, a guy like me, I need a familiar face. I need an in, because I'm not just going to come up and start talking to you, especially at the beginning. I'm crazy. And but I got out of rehab, and I wanted to do good. I wanted to do AA, and I couldn't do it. You know, I couldn't show up. I lacked any kind of power that was going to solve my problems. I hadn't done anything. I sat in a rehab in sweatpants for 30 days and attended a few AA meetings. And so there was, you know, I mean, that power that I lacked was still gone. It still wasn't there. And so what happened is my roommate in rehab, he was what the Big Book talks about when he talks about, and it's funny because I said this for a long time, I'll tell you about him, a little bit about him, but the Big Book talks about people as normal in all respects of their life except for their relationship with alcohol. And I thought that about him because he had a pretty girlfriend and his parents liked him and he had a good job that like held the job for him when he was getting out of rehab. My job might have, I didn't ask, you know, but they probably had another delivery guy. Those are high demand, you know, and so they needed a new one. So he had all those things, but he also had things like he had a tattoo of a heart on his chest, like a little spot that you put your girlfriend's name on it. But he hadn't met her yet, right? So he didn't have a name filled in. So, or I guess the girlfriend he had hadn't fulfilled that, you know, that lofty expectation of tattoo status yet. And so he had those kind of things. But to me, he looked so normal, you know. And what happened was he thought that he could drink wine safely, and he drank wine safely one night and he OD'd and he died. And so I went to a noon meeting the next day. And I waited to the end, and I shared about what had happened to my friend and that I was going to drink. And a young woman came up to me right after the meeting. And she stuck her hand out to me, and she said, you know, my name's Emery. We have a good young people's group. You should check us out. You might relate. And some stuff like that. And it's one of those things where I had, you know, one of those out-of-body kind of experiences where you see exactly what you're working with. You know, I'm like 220 pounds all in my cheeks and in my belly because of all the beer, you know. And I'm saying weird, weird stuff, like at the exact wrong time, you know. Like, should have just been mentioned earlier in the conversation. Or it's kind of like, what? You know. And so I knew from looking at it that she was not hitting on me. You know, like, it was obvious. You know, it was painfully obvious. And but human ego, to me, works, you know, very fast. Because by the time I get in my car, I think, hallelujah, yeah, she loves me. I can't wait to go to that meeting wherever she's at. And it was this group, and it was when we met over there, like Dave said, and I followed her, you know. And the group was tiny. There was like 8 or 9 people. I remember David was there. He had his hat real low and didn't say a word, you know, like for the first 3 months I knew him. And he just kind of sat quietly and scary looking and all that kind of stuff. But they had all these other people were so nice besides him. And, you know. Come to find out, he hated me, right? So that was part of it. It was probably because I had the I did have the front seat at first, but then I changed my sobriety date, so he got it. And now, so every year for 2 weeks, he calls me new guy, which is always a fun 2 weeks. All these people were so nice, and they stuck out their hand to me, and they welcomed me back. And you could tell from the way they carried themselves that they absolutely cared about AA, that it was the most important part of their day, you know, and that for them. It was cool to work the steps. You know, it was cool to worry about your home group. It was cool to sit quietly through it and then go to the hang afterwards and make the hang important. You know, you could tell all that stuff, and you could also just tell that they were happy. You know, you could see it the second they walked up to you, except for David. And they just all looked so happy. So I wanted what they had. And so I just kind of, They scooped me up. That's the only way to really explain it. Because like I said, I was a weird, quiet kid. You know, I wasn't saying much. I wasn't bringing much to the social table. And so they just kind of, tell me what meeting to be at, and I'd show up. And then I would say, okay, I got to go do laundry, so I'm going to go home and not go to the hang. And so they got wind of that, and so they would start giving me rides to the hang. So I had to show up. Little by little, to be honest, I dreamed about drinking every single night of my first 100 days of sobriety. I thought about it all day long. I had such an obsession. And what had happened was David was doing his second fist up. We have the same sponsor. And I didn't want to get too far behind in the looking good pigeon competition. You know, I had to, like, really stay up there in the running. And I knew I didn't have a lot else. So I had to at least maybe work at steps. And so that's why I did my first, fourth, and fifth step. But I was really, really honest on it. And I told him everything that I didn't want to say. I didn't think about it for a few months. But 3 or 4 or 5 months later, I thought about it. I remember I hadn't had a dream about drinking since. And the obsession had been removed, and it wasn't like I really did anything at all. You know, it had just been taken away. And I don't know of a bigger miracle for drunks like us than from, like, the obsession and the false impression that I can do this, that I can handle this on my own, that there's some sort of human thing that I can do to make this thing work. That false impression that we have, and all that was gone, and I knew I couldn't do it, and I knew it was being done for me. And I don't know anything better. But because of that, things start getting good. I don't drink. I got a job. I buy this house, and Dave and Eric are living there with me, and I got this girlfriend that I love, you know, because we've known each other a couple minutes now, and it's got to be a good move. And little by little, so she goes out and leaves me, and all this stuff, and I cry to David and Mike for the next 2 years of my life, you know, like, oh, I miss her so much, you know, and all this stuff, and I just need closure. And they're like, well, she's dating somebody else, that should be, you know what I mean, like, that's enough, right? And they look happy and, you know, joyous and all that stuff, and you're just still crying on the back porch, you know, you should get your act together. But what happened was is because of all that stuff, I saw that I didn't have any personal recovery in my life. I wasn't doing anything about AA. I was just showing up at your meetings, and I was picking up chairs because you told me I'd get a date if I picked up enough chairs here, and you lied to me. And I was active in service, but it's just like David was talking about. I wasn't doing any other stuff. And our sponsor, we were kind of in the same spot 1 week, and we both called, and he yelled at both of us and hung up on both of us. I think he was enjoying it that night, and he's just like, you know, put down the PlayStation controller and do something with your life. And so we just got active, and we got busy. And we started getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my life's so different. Mike came that day, you know. The day that she left me was the day that Mike asked me to sponsor him, you know. He was like, all right, you know, I guess this is what we're doing next, right? And I sponsored him. I was thinking about it this morning. In November, it'll be 10 years, you know. Like, that's crazy, you know. And lifelong friends. And here in AA, my life's so different, you know. Like, I've got to do all kinds of amazing stuff. I got married here. I love my wife. Most of you all know her. She's staying in Orlando this evening, but she makes me want to be better here. You know, she makes me want to be a kinder person to her. You know, like, she's the type of person for me that it's not like these other people on the street where if I wrong them, it's my inventory and I have to look at it and stuff. You know, I might feel bad about it for a little bit until my sponsor goes away. Like, I want to be better at my relationship with her. And I loved that. And then the best part about it is I looked around at our wedding, and it was like, it was almost like we flyered it here. You know, like the AA event that Saturday night was Ryan and Monica's wedding. And because everybody was there, you know, my two of the guys I sponsor were in my wedding. David was in my wedding. My sponsor was in my wedding. My dad was my best man. You know, my dad hated me when I got sober. That's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the other guys I sponsor was an usher. And we just like, and then the crowd was AA and random, you know, my drunken family. You know what I mean? Just those people. So I've gotten to see all that kind of stuff. And the coolest thing about all this is watching people like David and Mike become dads. And not only become dads, but become dads that I can look up to. You know, when I have kids, I can try and be a dad like they are. And I can guarantee you that 10 and 11 years ago, I did not think those things about those two guys. You know, but that's the case now. That's absolutely the truth about them. I see both of them and with their kids, and those are the things that just make me... You know, it's like Mike was talking about that stuff before. I don't cry much and stuff, but it got me teary-eyed right there. You hear Mike talk about those things. And, you know, AA is, it's funny. You know, I moved to Orlando 6 months ago. I thought I would never have another home group. I had this home group for 10 years, and I got a great home group over there. They go to Tijuana Flats every Thursday. They have a greeting line. It reminded me of home. You know, it was the second I walked in, I knew it was, you know, the closest thing I was going to find in my old home group. And so I found that. But it's been a trying 6 months for me, that's for sure. And it's been really hard. But one of the things that I've absolutely found out about myself is that when the going gets tough, AA shows up. That's one. We had some issues with my mom, and people from AA that I didn't know showed up to help clean our house, and people I know as well, you know, to help with it. But but just random AA people. Like, I heard you were an AA help. You needed AA help, you know, and that was it. We're here all day, and that's amazing to me. And you know, so I've gotten to watch that kind of stuff. And but I'm not as instinctually good there, you know, outside. I don't seek my instinct isn't to seek God when I'm out there. You know, my instinct is self-centered generally out there. But in here, you know, I have the opportunity that I see God working. You know, I get to see God working in your eyes and in the people I sponsor and in the guys I got sober with and watching it in the, you know, the guys and the girls in this room that I've gotten to watch get sober over the years. And I absolutely have no doubt in the workings of God when I'm here. It is, it's undeniable. And I can't get there on my own. You know, my life is unattainable on my own from the way it was before. I have a job that's really stressful the last 2 days. You know, I work a lot, but I know my most important job is in AA, and I feel a lot better when I know that. You know, sometimes I think that I just need to work all night and I'll fix this insecurity. You know what I mean? Which is backwards. So that's not how it works. But AA. For me, is the absolute certainty that there is some sort of God in my life, you know, and I don't know what that is, and I don't know if that freaks you guys out, and you know, and that's not really what my intent is, except for the fact that right here, right now, there's a bunch of self-centered, you know, loser drunks just like me that are here worried about helping others. You know, what else could that be besides some sort of power greater than myself, whether that be Alcoholics Anonymous or, you know, whatever you name it. I don't know what it is. But I can pretty much guarantee that if you're a drunk of my type, your life was probably unattainable also. And if it wasn't for the good people of AA that stuck out their hands to other people like us, I'd be dead. I don't know about anybody else, but my life wouldn't make it. You know, and so every single part of it, I think back all the time to those guys that just remembered my name out front when I'd walk to that greeting line and asked me to come back. And would invite me to their homes to show me how AA really works in their life. You know, like David was talking about, the winners, the people, you know, you'd show up at their house and you'd see how life is. And I'll tell you one quick story about Mike. So we were coming back from the Bahamas, right? It was me, Dave, Eric, and Mike. And me, Dave, and Eric made fun of Mike the whole time. I mean, he had like 5 years. We were calling him newcomer and, you know, new guy and all this stuff. And my dad doesn't know about AA very much, but he likes my friends. And so Mike gets near the door of the plane. It's a small plane. And Dad goes to me and goes, "You better watch out for Mike. You're going to get another new guy." And that's just like, yes. You know what I mean? That is awesome. But any time to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, is an honor. It's a privilege. It's some sort of... unearned gift. You know, it's something that the best part about tonight is a couple of the guys that I that I'm friends with in Orlando now. They met me at my office and they rode over with me. And we're gonna drive back tonight, and I'm gonna be tired for work tomorrow. But you know, getting to see these guys was all I really wanted to do. You know, getting to see the guys I rolled over with, getting to see Mike and some of my friends here, and I hadn't seen Steven and Annie since they had their baby, and you know, to see those guys, to see the light of AA in people's eyes was an opportunity I couldn't miss. So thank you all for having me, and that's all I got.